Consortium is an emerging center of excellence, a center of excellence for ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building. Talking to you here is Basil Ogorji, broadcasting live from our headquarters here in New York. I bring you peace and blessings. And I hope you have a wonderful time with us as you sit and relax and listen to our show.
Wonderful. And I am your co-host, Jacqueline Kalaga. So peace and blessings to you, our listeners, and our guests from the United States and around the world. Thank you so much for joining us today on this important discussion, which today we're theming law, genocide, and conflict resolution. Just to give you some information, this episode focuses on the violations of national and international laws during ethnic and religious wars and how conflict with ethnic and religious elements could be resolved to create a pathway for peace and security. This interview today will be based on relevant lessons learned through Dr. Peter McGuire and his work in Cambodia, and how his findings on the Cambodian genocide could help us to understand what has happened and what is currently happening in other countries where genocide and ethnic cleansings have occurred and still are occurring today.
That's right, Jacqueline. And to situate Dr. McGuire's work on the Cambodian genocide within a global context, we shall, in this very program that we are broadcasting right now, remind our listeners about some of the worst genocides in the history of mankind, including but not limited to the genocide of the Native Americans that occurred between 1492 to 1900, which was a very terrible and horrible event. The Greek genocide, which occurred between 1915 until 1918. We can't forget the Armenian genocide that occurred between 1915 and 23. What about the Assyrian genocide, the Holocaust between 1933 to 45, the Romani genocide, which occurred between 1935 until 1945. One of the genocides that most people ignore and up to today do not really acknowledge that it happened is the Nigerian Civil War and the massacres of the Biafran people between 1967 until 1970. The Bangladesh genocide occurred between occurred in 1971. And we also had the massacres of the Hutus in Burundi, which actually gave birth to the Rwandan genocide in 1994, the Bosnian genocide in 1995, the Darfur War in Sudan 2003 until 2010, and the ongoing genocide in Syria and Iraq, which, of course, the whole world is paying close attention and watching millions of people leave Syria and Iraq, and so many have been killed, including children and women.
Absolutely, Basil. And interestingly enough, many of us are probably not aware or are beginning to become more aware and currently witnessing some other forms of genocide and other atrocities that are not only occurring by the notorious group ISIS in Syria and Iraq, but also we're also seeing Boko Haram groups in northern Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and other states that we're seeing, and nonviolent, extremists around the world. So, what is scary is that some of the genocides that you're mentioning, for example, the Nigerian civil war, and massacres by the Biafran people, the Bangladesh genocide, massacres of the Hutus in Burundi, the Rwandan genocide. You spoke about the Bosnian genocide, the Darfur War in Sudan. What makes this all very scary is all of these genocides and many other deadly wars have occurred at the end of World War II and after the signing and the adoption of the United Nations Charter, which was on June 26, 1945. And that was provided by the United Nations an international mandate for arbitrating international conflict and negotiating peace. It was then provided, you know, that before with the old League of Nations. But looking at all of these post-World War II genocides, many people could argue that the United Nations is failing in some of the of their mandates. So in this episode, we would really like to examine how international law has been violated, as well as some of the ineffectiveness of the international community in preventing genocide before they occur, and their failure in bringing some of the perpetrators to justice. So in the end, the efforts that will be made to discuss how other types of conflict resolution, if we look at diplomacy, mediation, dialogue, arbitration, and so on and so forth, we would like to see how those things can be utilized to prevent or resolve conflict with ethnic and religious components.
Thank you, Jacqueline, for helping us understand the focus of this episode. Before we introduce our esteemed guest for today's discussion on law, genocide, and conflict resolution, we will take a short break. And when we return, we will have a meaningful conversation with our guest who is here with us in our studio. Please just take a moment and take a deep breath and relax. When we come back, we continue.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back. For those who are just joining us, I see many people are calling in to listen to this discussion. It's going to be an interesting discussion. You are listening to the ICERM radio program. Let's talk about it. Now, today we're discussing law, genocide, and conflict resolution with Dr. Peter McGuire, the author of Law and War, International Law and American History. This book was published in 2010 by Columbia University Press. And he also authored another book, which is entitled Facing Death in Cambodia, and a book that was also published by Columbia University Press in 2005. Now, Peter is a historian. He's also a former war crimes investigator, whose writings have been published in International Herald, Tribune, New York Times, The Independent, Newsday, and Boston Globe. He has taught law and war theory at Columbia University. Now, it is my honor in this very program where we are, and high privilege to introduce to you, our listeners, our guest for today's discussion, Dr. Peter McGuire. Dr. McGuire, welcome to ICERM Radio.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Welcome, Dr. McGuire. And to our listeners, we thank you again for tuning in. This is going to be a public dialogue, so feel free to call in into the show with and voice your concerns, if you have anything you would like to add to the discussion, and make your views be known to the world. So the number to call us is area code 323-642-1236. Again, to ask questions or to contribute to the discussion, call 323-642-1236. Now, again, if you're outside of the United States, you must dial 1 before 323-642-1236.
Thank you, Jacqueline. I hope a lot of people have got so many questions to ask Dr. McGuire, our esteemed guest for today's show. But let me begin by asking Dr. Peter a very simple question. Dr. McGuire, you have done a great deal of work and research in Cambodia, and not only in Cambodia, in many other countries around the world. And you are also a journalist, and your works have been published in so many places. Now, I just want to ask you if you could please tell our listeners a little bit about you and about your work in Cambodia, but again, especially your findings on the Cambodian genocide.
Sure. Well, I came to this subject in college because my great-grandfather was a judge at the Nuremberg trials, and I was studying his cases and quickly learned that many of the men he had sentenced to long prison terms were released far, far before the time their sentences had expired. And that became sort of the subject of my first book, where I talk about how the German and Japanese war criminals were really traded during the Cold War for German and Japanese rearmament. So I received my PhD at 28, but really felt like I was lacking practical knowledge of these subjects. At the time, the United Nations was finishing up their occupation of Cambodia, which in my mind was the worst war crime situation of the post-World War II period. And no one was ever punished at that point, and it looked like no one ever would be. Initially, my goal was to preserve the evidence of atrocities so that historical revisionism would be impossible. At the time, the Khmer Rouge were recasting themselves as nationalist saviors and basically blaming the Cambodian genocide, if you will, on the Vietnamese. It was a very confused time. And so that's what initially got me going. And then after collecting photographs and interviewing perpetrators and victims, the Khmer Rouge split up. And for the first time, it looked like there was the possibility of a trial. And at that point, I shifted my attention to the war crimes trials that were very limited in scope. I mean, they really have only tried a very small handful of senior leaders. But I must concede, I never ever thought that there would be any Khmer Rouge leaders held accountable for genocide.
That is very, very, very sad, because it's something that is happening in many other countries, not just only in Cambodia. But again, we're going to come back to the things that are happening in other countries, or the genocides that occurred in many countries we mentioned during our introduction. But I want to follow up with your introduction and your work in Cambodia. Could you help us understand what happened in a special way, why those leaders were not tried?
Very, very similar to the situation after World War II in Germany, that basically Cambodia's internal problems were overshadowed by Cold War politics. When the Vietnamese military invaded Cambodia in early 1979, the United States and China basically kept the Khmer Rouge alive with the help of the Thai government. And it was a geopolitical chessboard move. We didn't want the Vietnamese gaining any more power in the region, so those geopolitical strategic interests took precedence over human rights interests. The United States, including the Carter administration, but particularly the Reagan administration, they provided the Khmer Rouge with support and arms. But no one was more of a generous benefactor to the Khmer Rouge than China. They kept them alive, propped them up, denied any culpability, and they'll deny their culpability even to this day. So once again, we see geopolitics overshadowing human rights concerns, and that's what we're seeing in the Middle East as well now. This ISIS situation is a real political mess because of our alliance with Turkey, and then our former allies, the Kurds, are looking like, the Polish of the late of the beginning of the 21st century. I mean, the Kurds have suffered quite a bit, and the Turks are now pushing us to denounce them as well. So it's the engine of geopolitics is a mighty one.
Right. And Dr. McGuire, I realize that it wasn't until the early 2000s that in Cambodia we really begun to see tribunals take place and people being held accountable for their crimes. And it was it in 2013 that finally in Cambodia that we're now seeing that the denial of any of these atrocities occurring is finally being made illegal. Is that correct in my understanding?
I'm not sure what the law on the books is in Cambodia, because the law is quite a flexible, arbitrary mm-hmm. instrument in Cambodia. But nonetheless,
right.
what we are seeing, though, is a really wonderful, organic emergence of Cambodian civic leaders like Yuk Chang of the Documentation Center of Cambodia and Rithi Pan and, you know, homegrown people who live through this, basically taking it and helping heal their own countries within their own cultural and religious context. I mean, keep in mind that Cambodia is a Buddhist country, so
right.
Judeo-Christian concepts of justice and jurisprudence fall very flat. A life sentence, when I talked to one Cambodian and I said, well, you know, are you happy that the commandant of this prison camp who ordered the executions of probably 20,000 people is going to be in prison for the rest of his life? And he laughed and he said, well, he's got to come back for the next 1,000 lifetimes as a cockroach. And that's his karma. And so if you're looking at it through the lens of Buddhism, you'll be paying for lifetimes and lifetimes to come. So it's very confusing. I first went to Cambodia in the beginning of 1994. The UN had basically abdicated responsibility for any accountability for any war crimes. And they basically, their goal was to hold an election and to try to cobble together a coalition government. So the job of collecting evidence and trying to preserve the historical legacy really fell to people like myself. People like myself, Yuk Chang, Craig Etchison, and a host of others were the ones initially who were doing all this work. And once this material was assembled at the Documentation Center of Cambodia, the UN came in and did what lawyers do. And then they provide a completely different set of services. But the lawyer's job and the investigator's job are two entirely different ones.
Right. And, you know, for me, as someone who has, has general knowledge about this, thinking that it was 1979 that the KR was finally overthrown, to finally begin seeing progress in I guess maybe restitution, if you will, or punishments, that was quite a length of time for that to occur. What do you think are some of the factors that led up to that?
Well, the main thing was the Khmer Rouge was still a major force to be reckoned with up until the late 90s. And there was basically an internal war between the faction led by Pol Pot and Thom Ok and the faction led by Ing Seri. And so once that final conflict was done, then the door was opened for possible trials, but it was also very tricky because Ing Seri surrendered to the Cambodian government, and it was unclear whether or not the prime minister gave him an amnesty. And sometimes there's some very dirty political deals that are made to end wars. Very few wars end as cleanly as World War II in the sense of the Germans, they were completely devastated and defeated, and they were subjected to a vae victis, unconditional surrender, woe to the conquered, and they had to accept the terms that were imposed on them. And so typically you've got a brokered peace, not a decisive victory, and you have people in the old regimes that might be guilty or culpable still sort of out there and involved in the government on some level, as is the case in Cambodia today. There are a number of senior government people that were members of the Khmer Rouge that, you know, are still out there floating around. And so it makes it very, very difficult to try to have, quote, perfect justice. It's what I describe as political justice. And by describing it as political justice is not to condemn it. It is just to accept it for what it is, that you have history and law and politics in a constant state of flux. And on the low end of political justice, you would have trials like Stalin's show trials. On the high end of political justice, I would say you would have a trial like Nuremberg's International Military Tribunal, which had problems as well. The Milosevic case, in my opinion, was too perfect. And after the end of the Cold War, we begin to see a kind of obsession within the world of international criminal law with procedural perfection and the notion that if they can have a procedurally perfect trial, somehow the political aspect of this is going to go away. And I think that's it's intellectually dishonest. It's better to just accept the fact that politics will always play a role in these sorts of trials, and to kind of ameliorate the worst aspects of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, the way that, you know, I've kind of interpreted a lot of these different things, as well as many other people, I'm sure, is that the type of politics and the type of creation, I guess, of justice, really, it falls to Western ideology. And you mentioned even before, it's counterproductive in cultures and communities where they have their own ethnic and religious concepts of what justice looks like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think to many Cambodians, the amount of time, money, and energy spent on these trials is a little bit baffling, where, you know, a moto taxi thief gets beaten to death in the street, even sometimes to this day. And there is a strong history and tradition of real vigilante justice. And then they see the leader who ordered the deaths of, you know, roughly 2 million in 3 years and 10 months. And, you know, they're living in an air-conditioned cell, and they're given presumption of innocence and things that are absolutely unheard of in Cambodia. And so to them, to see this kind of, you know, obsession with procedural detail, I think many find quite frustrating.
Thank you, Dr. McGuire. For those who are just joining us, we've been talking and discussing with Dr. Peter McGuire, who is the author of Law and War, International Law and American History, a book published in 2010 by Columbia University Press. We're going to be taking a short break right now. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a very important questions, more questions for Dr. Peter McGuire. We're going to be applying his lessons, the lessons he learned from his research in Cambodia, to other countries, countries like Nigeria, 1967 to 1970. Many people, or more than 3 million people, were killed. And in many other countries, especially what's going on right now in Syria and Iraq. And we're going to be finding a way to apply his lessons to those very countries. When we come back, we continue.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, and our esteemed guest, Dr. Peter McGuire. Now, Dr. McGuire, you've been talking about very crucial, very important topics. And you mentioned, you talked about the international community, you talked about immunity, you talked about law, you talked about politics, international politics, alliances, and all that. And I know you had, you know, done a great work in Cambodia, and you've also accumulated a whole lot of experiences. And one of the things that we seek in this very show and in our organization is to apply some of the lessons learned to current events and also to help us understand what's going on around the world, what happened in so many other countries. Now, my question to you, Dr. McGuire, is how could we understand, for instance, the genocide that occurred in Rwanda, genocide that occurred in Nigeria? Many people deny it. The ones that occurred in so many other countries. And secondly, what is happening right now in Syria, in Iraq? How could we understand through the lenses of your research in Cambodia?
Well, I think, I mean, Rwanda, in my opinion, was one of the worst examples of genocide of the 20th century. And I remember being in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, at the time it was going on and seeing on the news hundreds of thousands of refugees pouring out of Rwanda, and it was very clear that something truly horrific was going on. But Rwanda is not a geopolitically significant country, so there was very little attention paid to it as compared to, say, former Yugoslavia, where as awful as the atrocities were there, they were nowhere near on the scale of Rwanda, yet that really took center stage, and everything from the actual UN's intervention to the trials, former Yugoslavia got much more attention and resources. So sadly, we see that countries of very little geostrategic importance typically suffer the worst. And the Middle East right now is of great strategic importance, and there seems to be quite a bit of attention being paid to it, but I really don't see much action. I've been the American inaction on ISIS was very conspicuous to me, and I felt there was a larger, you know, geopolitical undercurrent going on right there, and that seems in my mind to be playing out. We're conflicted. I mean, what's most troubling about the present-day situation in the Middle East is that those artificial borders that were created largely by the British are beginning to break down, and we're moving back towards the most brutal form of warfare, which is tribal warfare, Sunni versus Shia, you know, that type of, you know, ethnic and religious warfare. Next to civil war, that's typically the most brutal. War under the sovereign state system, I wouldn't say it was clean, I wouldn't say it was better by any measure, but it was more regulated, or at least interstate conflict between European nations it was moving in that direction, but we seem to have regressed from that, and we're moving towards a much more base and brutal forms of war.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful, Dr. McGuire. And 2 points that you raised here that caused the inaction of the government here in America. One of the points that you raised is the geopolitical strategy of the government in power. And in 1994, in fact, prior to 1994, 1993, when the symptoms, or even from 1991, when the symptoms of the Rwandan genocide was actually made manifest, the then President Clinton actually did not intervene. He hesitated. And the same inaction, the same thing is actually happening in this current administration, where President Obama seemed to have hesitated to intervene in Syria and in Iraq, which created a vacuum, as many strategists or analysts have really said. It created a vacuum for ethnic cleansing, for the emergence of ISIS and many other sectarian groups that have really been fighting in Syria and Iraq. What do you make of this inaction of the government?
Well, I would say that Rwanda was actually much, much worse, because not only did the Clinton administration refuse to act or acknowledge it. In fact, I think Susan Rice was the in office or the official at the time. They even denied that genocide was going on, because if they did admit genocide was going on, then there was a threshold of action required by the United States. And after that, it was very clear what had happened. President Clinton, you know, went to Rwanda, was at Kigali Airport, apologized to the Rwandan people. But in my opinion, that's very, very cold comfort. And that the games that both the neoconservatives and the humanitarian hawks have been playing in the Middle East with, you know, basically launching and supporting aggressive wars and overthrowing governments of sovereign nations is a very, very dangerous game. And the idea that this is becoming acceptable American foreign policy, bipartisan from both sides, is incredibly regrettable to me. Most shocking to me is the role that has been played by Samantha Power, who was, you know, won the Pulitzer Prize for a book on genocide, where she basically claimed, you know, that the United States could never sit back and stand by and watch this happen again. Yet on her watch, we've watched, you know, admittedly, the Obama administration inherited a complete and utter mess. So I will not lump all the blame on them. However, the adventurism in Libya and Syria, that's very much on their plate. And those conflicts are far from resolved. And our foreign policy is as incoherent as ever.
And that is a very important point that you just mentioned. And one of the things that we do here through this very program is to look at things from a positive perspective. And as you say, that you're not laying blames on people, but what we're trying to do is to prevent such things from happening again. And my concern, which brings me to the next question, is that in Libya, Libya was just emerging, and though there was kind of chaos, but there was no genocide occurring in Libya but during the Arab Spring prior to the intervention of the Allied forces, if I may use that term. Now, in many other places where we had in history where genocide occurred, for instance, we watched in those days after the founding of the United Nations and the signing of the Charter of the United Nations, as we said in our introduction, we watched horrific, very terrible, you know, genocidal events take place in many countries. We could not even prevent all that. And we had millions of people, children, women, killed, sent to their graves. And we watched that and all that happened. Now, why did the Obama administration decide to intervene in Libya, plus, you know, in addition or in coalition with other governments that led to the death of Gaddafi?
There are many, I mean, people speculate about, you know, everything from Libya wanting to go to the gold standard to the Nubian Aquifer, which is one of the biggest freshwater springs on the planet underneath Libya. To be honest, I don't think anybody knows the real answer. I think that we, you know, it's very clear that the neoconservatives had planned on basically waging a series of wars in the Middle East and recasting the Middle East in an image that would be friendly to the United States and Israel. And it was, if nothing else, incredibly ambitious, but it failed on so many levels, and beginning with Iraq. And that was one of the most colossal failures in American military history. And the bill for that is yet to come. I mean, America lost quite a bit of blood and treasure, young American lives, not even to mention the, you know, the Iraqis and what they suffered, and setting up a situation where you know, you've got a generation of alienated young men that are easy recruits for ISIS now. You know, the United States did them did ourselves no public relations favors, this game of international politics is a very complex one, but it has rules. It has, I feel like we're kind of making it up as we go along, the United States, that is. And, you go back to Thucydides, 416 B.C., and he says very clearly, talking about power and equality, that there's really only, equity among equal powers, and that the weak have to accept what the weak have to accept, the strong do as they want. I don't think this is right or fair, but when we delude ourselves, we set ourselves up for bigger failures. And worse, in my opinion, and America has a long history of this, is our treatment of our allies, people that we encourage to take up arms and fight for their freedom, whether it's the Cambodians, whether it's the Iraqis, whether it's the Afghanis, and then we simply abandon them and leave them to be slaughtered. And that's that makes the currency of the American word incredibly weak. I'm very troubled by, the situation the Kurds are in, the situation our Afghan allies are in. I have friends in the military that are, that are trying to get their translators and people that save their lives in war. They're trying to get them, status as refugees to the United States, and they can't get them into the United States. They certainly will be, if they can't successfully get out of Afghanistan sooner or later, they'll be killed. So it's this is a very high stakes game.
Very, very important. And I'm going to call my co-host, colleague, Jacqueline, to ask her an important question that she has right there with her now.
Yeah, absolutely. There are just a few things that I hear if we are just looking at, all of these different situations, especially when we're talking about what's going on in Syria, what we see happening in Cambodia and around the world. There are people, and this is, again, just to play a devil's advocate to a lot of what you're saying, that a lot of people who feel that because these are issues that are not specifically Western problems, so to speak, where they do feel that, the interference of the Western communities coming in and establishing their laws and their rules and their style of warfare, because it has nothing to do with them. There are those people who want to keep the United States and the UK out. What would you say to those individuals who come back with a lot of those concerns and the involvement of the international community?
I think particularly the US and the UK at the moment, we're not standing on very firm ground in terms of our past performance in the very recent past. And it's very, very difficult for anybody who knows anything about the Middle East to take us that seriously when we turn a blind eye to Sharia law in Saudi Arabia, because they're our allies. But in fact, if we were really serious about this, we would begin with the Saudis and take a hard look at them. But we're very compromised by these long alliances we've had in the Middle East that are breaking down rapidly. And as I said, things are regressing back to a tribal system. I think America could stand some humility at the moment, but at the same time, it's problematic because Putin's going to fill that power vacuum, and really already has. Mm-hmm. And has acted decisively and like a leader, agree with him or disagree with him. I mean, to watch the rise of ISIS with all the U.S. military hardware and them, you know, clear cutting a swath through the Middle East. It was almost bizarre. I mean, this is not difficult, you know, with American military hardware like A-10 Warthogs, you know, the kind of tank busting plane. I was baffled. And then the Obama administration response, why they're not doing anything, was, well, if we bomb the oil that's supporting ISIS, then we're going to create an environmental problem because of the, you know, oil smoke in the atmosphere. And to me, that's a very strange calculus. Yes, I agree, pollution is bad, but I think genocide is worse.
Hello?
This program is brought to you by ISERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.iserm-mediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, and our guest, Dr. McGuire. If you're just joining us, we've been discussing with Dr. McGuire. He's a scholar in international law, and he just published a book on his findings in the Cambodian genocide. And I was asking Dr. McGuire before we went on a short break about the ineffectiveness of the International Criminal Court. Dr. McGuire, what is your take when it comes to the ineffectiveness of the International Criminal Court in prosecuting perpetrators of war and genocide?
Well, it's always the biggest problem international law has always faced is an enforcement mechanism, and so it's very difficult to bring Security Council powers up on war crimes charges, and so. That's always been, you know, since the time of Grotius and Lauterpacht and the real so-called fathers of international law, that's always been the most glaring problem. And in the case of Cambodia, when the UN military was there and they had extremely solid leading edge troops like the French Foreign Legion, Australian SAS, and others. The leadership didn't have the political will to send them to engage the Khmer Rouge. And so you had the military grow quite disaffected. Many of the French generals resigned. So it's two things. It's enforcement mechanisms, and it's, above all, political will. There's no underestimating the importance of political will.
Mm. All right. We have many listeners here. We want to take a few calls. And after that, we're going to continue with the conversation with our guest, Dr. McGuire. The first call we're going to be taking is a question from Roslyn. Roslyn is calling from Florida. Hi, Roslyn. Please, can you quickly ask your question?
Yeah, thank you so much for the insight you're providing when it comes to the role played by different countries when it comes to the issue of all these mass atrocities. My question is, why is there reluctance in calling some of these atrocities genocide, even when they fit into the widely accepted definition of genocide? If you take the Rwandan case, for instance, as an example, it took a long debate back and forth before eventually it was accepted as a genocide. And then even when it was accepted, the debate again went further to they went further to debate whether it's supposed to be called genocide against the Tutsis or the Rwandan genocide. And then I just have the list of at the beginning of the program, some of these civil wars, mass atrocities, and all that were all grouped as part of the genocide, like the Nigerian Biafran Civil War.
Sure.
You know,
well, I think,
and then there
I
are
have,
some.
Yeah. What I would say, I would say, you know, genocide after World War II became kind of what I would call a cachet crime. That is somehow, if you were a victim of genocide, it was at the top of the pyramid of really criminal law. But in fact, if you look back at the Nuremberg trials, the category of crimes against humanity was created, as really the largest category of international criminal law and the worst category. So to me, this is a very distracting kind of semantic debate at times. There was a huge debate in Cambodia. Was it genocide? How could it be genocide if it was Cambodians killing other Cambodians? There were examples of genocide within it, with the killing of the Muslims or the Buddhists. In fact, the situation in Cambodia, it exceeded the definition of genocide. And in the case of Rwanda, there's no question that that was genocide. And the reason that that got caught up in a debate about the definition was because if the United States called it genocide, then we would have been required to act and move on it, that we were basically buying time. Does that answer your question, Rosalind?
Yeah, definitely it does.
All right. Rosalind,
it's all about the interest of whoever is, you know. Thank you so much.
All right, Rosalind, thank you for asking that important question to our guest, Dr. Maguire. And we have another caller on the line, Kelechi Mbemnozi. Kelechi is calling from New York here. Kelechi, please, can you ask your question?
Thank you, Basil. And thank you, Dr. Maguire, for this elaborate illustration on genocide. I have a question, and also I have a contribution on some of the issues that you talked about before. My question is this: why is it that within the multilateral system, especially at the United Nations level, United Nations having the obligation to stop all these genocides from happening? Because I believe we have all the mechanisms to see the early warning signs. Genocide don't just happen overnight.
Right.
Ban Ki-moon will always tell us that it's keenly than ever that genocide is not a single event, but a process that evolves over time and requires planning and resources to carry out. What it means is that anytime we have a genocide in a particular country, whether it is in Rwanda or what happened in Srebrenica or what happened in Sudan or what went on during the Biafran War, all these were strategically calculated effort by either the existing government of the time, which we as citizens can also, we can feel the early warning signs that this is likely to happen. Why is it that the United Nations cannot take action in the sense that to deploy maybe extra peacekeeping missions in those countries to quell those crises from getting out of hand? Why must they wait for any member of the P5 to make a pronouncement? We're waiting for America to decide whether we should go, like what happened in Rwanda, or we're waiting for Britain to make to decide if we should go because the Danish government is interested in the case, or they have an interest in the resources in Rwanda. So why the whole? For me, is a very big disappointment, because even as we speak today, genocide is still going on all around the world, and nothing has been done about it, and it's just very sad.
Yeah, no, I would concur. I think, as I said, the structure of the UN, with having, some more equal than others, the Security Council powers, and making it difficult to mobilize, because perhaps you know, a Security Council power ally is the one committing and carrying out the genocide, and their big brother is covering up for them. But this is old alliance politics, and this is, you know, as tragic as it is, it's nature of international politics. I wish I was more optimistic about this, but I fear I've seen too much. And in you know, since 9/11, we've really gone downhill quickly, and the gloves have come off. I mean, never in my lifetime I would think that the United States would recheck the Hague and Geneva agreements, that the United States would condemn torture as an instrument of national policy. This is unprecedented.
Very important, Dr. McGuire. And the social media has done a lot these days to help us understand what is going on around the world. And I begin to imagine exactly what happened prior to the emergence of social media. A lot of stuff must have happened in secret, that so many people or so many of us we are unaware of. And I just have a very you know, so much sympathy for a lot of families who lost their dear ones in genocide. Now we're going to be taking one more question from Angelbert Chikere, who is calling from California. Angelbert, can you ask your question, please?
Probably I'll put it in a way of contribution to what Dr. McGuire have been saying all along. We are looking at a situation in the world where we have the role of politics, as dirty or as clean as it might be, and the proper exposition of what is justice. I would acknowledge and also agree with Dr. McGuire when he talks about the geopolitical significance of certain locations. He spoke about Rwanda and Yugoslavia. I would want to disagree on another level with him when he says we are in this advanced time of technology and the warfare and how war is being waged on people is more technological. But if we can notice the symptoms, because be it a full-scale war between nations, be it an in-house war in a country like we're seeing in Syria right now, it always has a beginning. There's always the symptom that grows with it. There's a start. And if we dig into this, most times we would realize it is ethno-religious. And as much as I want to disagree with you that I didn't get it clearly, or you didn't make it clear enough. But the point I'm disagreeing is, we could always have a way forward in nibbing this from the bud before it comes out, because then we have to address, if it's an ethno crisis, we don't begin by having ammunition thrown into that country, taking sides. We are called upon as agents of peace and reconciliation to bring these ethno leaders to the table, to bring these religious leaders to the table, you know, so that there can be a proper dialogue before even the intervention. So I'm trying to come from the position of a pro action than a reaction, because
right.
International politics has dwindled the efforts of pro action. So we wait for it, because we have a particular political interest in that region, then we would wait for the war to escalate, and then we go as a reaction to it, which for me I think is detrimental.
No, I would agree with you that our policies are typically very reactionary, and they're pregnant with a whole host of other issues, whether, as you correctly pointed out, natural resources, geostrategic import. So, you know, these are rarely simple. They're rarely, you know, bi-causal. The one thing I would say is, what I see often is that until the events on the ground have played out, it becomes very difficult to negotiate a peace, as awful as that is. The conflict often has to play itself out, or it needs to be, you know, ended by a powerful peacekeeping force, which, should have happened in Cambodia, but it really didn't, because at the time the UNTAC, United Nations forces, were unwilling to engage with the ones who were screwing up the peace process, which were the Khmer Rouge. And that was their policy, was to disrupt the election and to sow discord between the parties that were trying to negotiate in good faith.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you again, Andrew, for your call. And Dr. McGuire, what I would, to kind of follow up with a lot of what we've been discussing as far as we're looking at these technologies and media, one question I really wanted to kind of bring to your attention, after many of these genocides and the aftermath of all of these atrocities that happen, there is a quote-unquote peacekeeping process or a way to kind of remedy what has been done wrong. And if I may kind of turn back to Cambodia for a moment, and I'm sure this is a very similar across the globe, many individuals have brought to my attention the use of media. And when you have regimes that are ending and we're beginning into new governments, it sometimes is still corrupt and sometimes a little bit slippery. And from my friend's experience, they say that the use of media is fine for the government until it becomes too international and too many people are hearing about the imperfections of their country. And that's, I think, when a lot of people are finding themselves, and particularly individuals that I know of who have been jailed and tortured because they've brought too much attention to a particular issue. And one person I would like to kind of bring to your attention is Somali Mom. Now, she was not jailed, but
No, I know who she is.
Right. She and her organization, for those who are not aware, was established to help young victims of trafficking and to kind of help rehabilitate and create lives for them. And I believe in 2009, 2010, there began a generating in the media about her work and that she was telling lies and she was
Fabricating and coaching her, the supposed girls that she bought out of prostitution and things like
right.
that.
Right. And not just the idea that when someone like Somali Mom or other individuals I know that have been doing a lot of work out of Cambodia, when they begin to involve the international community to highlight a lot of the corruption that goes on in Cambodia, that's when I've seen or I've heard that the government has kind of put lockdowns on those individuals and have found ways to tarnish their name or to just jail them and torture them. What do you
right.
say to those things? Are those fairly accurate, would you say? And obviously these are issues I'm sure are going on around the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say that Somali Ma'am, she was a remarkable operator in, no other way to say it. And, she was the toast of the Susan Sarandons and many people in Hollywood and did some good work on some level. But then, a lot of troubling revelations came out that really can't be denied. But to a larger, more important point, social media cuts both ways. It's remarkable in that people can get instant information that the middleman of the media, the so-called corporate media, is cut out. But at the same time, it can be incredibly dangerous. I was in Cambodia during the Thai riots when supposedly this Thai soap opera actress said that Angkor Wat belongs to Thailand. We had her on the phone in a half an hour, and she said, "I said nothing of this." But it was whipped up on social media with an end goal of disrupting Thai business in Cambodia. And within 48 hours, orchestrated mobs of Cambodians were going and destroying every Thai business, every Thai hotel, and what was their favorite means of communication? Text messaging. And so the problem with social media sometimes is that it's very, very easy to make inaccurate or deceptive information appear totally credible. And I have this with students all the time where, you know, they'll bring something very cleverly packaged to me that they got online or something else, and the information will be completely bogus. But evidentiary standards, people, they're not the same as they once were. And so people are much quicker to believe. There's a great lack of trust now within the mainstream media, and deservedly so. I think when papers like the New York Times aid and abet an administration the way that they did in the lead up to the Iraq war, they deserve to be distrusted. But at the same time, I don't turn to Vice for, you know, credible reporting when I really want to get to the bottom of it. Occasionally, you know, they'll hit one out of the park, and, you know, they had some good stuff on ISIS in the very beginning. But again, you know, this idea that you don't have to pay journalism. I mean, journalists and Arianna Huffington's model of take, take, take has really hurt journalism. And it's really there aren't the kind of real reporters out there that there used to be. Guys like Nate Thayer, who, you know, nearly died following the story of Pol Pot and was the last person to interview Pol Pot. Guys like Ed Villamy, who was one of the important people to expose the Serb atrocities in the former Yugoslavian war. I mean, these are remarkable, remarkable people. And they're still out there, but they're having a very difficult time making a living.
Right. And even further to say how not even just social media, but just media in general now has kind of discredited themselves. How much, though, can that hurt hurt these places where a lot of these atrocities are occurring? I mean, we have mobs looking to find who is leaking information that may or may not be true, or feeding off of information that's false, and then further perpetrating violence every level. You know, what does that do now to a situation like Syria, or with the refugees, or what, or whomever across the globe?
Yeah, you're putting people's necks on the chopping block, and you have to be, you know, there's the way information is used, the way you treat your sources, things like that. Sadly, I find, you know, journalists in this kind of new internet age often not as careful and respectful of their sources as they should be. Because, for example, I introduced a journalist, quite a high-profile journalist, to one of my right-hand men in Cambodia, one of my so-called fixers, and he wrote a long story for a major national magazine, and he named him. And I was absolutely flabbergasted that he did that. And nothing in the end happened, but nonetheless, that's against the rules that I play by.
Right. And I mean, even, you know, we're in places like Cambodia, to kind of leak that information or be sloppy with your journalism and your ethics and your morals, I think that's where we're seeing a lot of individuals getting, you know, the finger pointed their direction. And I think that's where you're still seeing a lot of this corruption going on. And it might not be on such a grand scale like, you know, that we would think we are seeing it on, you know, a breaking news from CNN or whatnot, but small episodes of corruption do add up after a while.
Well, it becomes, after a while, it simply becomes another form of government. It's, you know, corruption as just as a democracy, and that in true corruption, like Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, you know, you basically, if you wanted something, I don't want to say Kwame Nkrumah, I'm not sure if that's right, so I'll retract that, but there are political systems where you simply know if you want this service or these goods through the government, you have to pay. And you know, to some extent, we see that in Cambodia, where it's just an accepted fact of political life. And to call it corrupt isn't even to condemn it. It's just to recognize it as the form of government that it is.
Well, and again, just speaking to what you're saying too, though, if we're taking in cultural context, then, you know, when we are speaking about people who do lie to further their organization or to kind of manhandle, you know, government officials or whatnot, would you even say that, you know, it is part of, let's say, Southeast Asian, I don't want to say it's the culture itself, but embellishing on a story or taking a certain spin on a particular issue, doesn't that sometimes work where that's just part of a selling point, really?
Absolutely works. I mean, you know, I was flabbergasted by the Thai riots because, you know, many Cambodians I'd known, gosh, 15 years and really thought I understood them and how they thought, they got completely swept up in the whole thing. And so it's, yeah, it was very eye-opening to me to see that giving people these devices of technology, you don't necessarily transfer the knowledge, the ways that they should be used, the standards of evidence. You know, it doesn't come with buying an iPhone, but suddenly you've got all this stuff at your fingertips and your ability to post and to do this and to do that. And yeah, some of it's done very sloppily and very, very carelessly, and some of it's just pure and simple propaganda. And some of the efforts the U.S. has been engaged in, particularly in the Middle East, I mean, it's just laughably bad propaganda at times. And so then distrust creeps into the whole system, and it, no, you know, if you have a set of beliefs that the war on terror was a great thing and that we should be waging war on all Muslims, then you're going to hold to those beliefs. If you believe that this was awful and, you know, the United States has become imperialist, then you're going to stick to those beliefs. And because neither side really trusts the information of the other side, there's no bridge. There's no real dialogue. And sadly, that's kind of what we're seeing with the American political system at the moment, that, you know, you've got the Trump backers. You're not going to change their minds. You've got, you know, the Sanders backers. They're not going to change their minds. You've got kind of Hillary in the sort of compromise middle, but nobody's talking to anybody. It's a very perilous time that we're living in.
Great, Dr. Peter McGuire. For those who are just joining us, I've been discussing with Dr. Peter McGuire, who is the author of Law and War, International Law and American History, a book published in 2010 by Columbia University Press. He is also the author of Facing Death in Cambodia, also published by Columbia University Press in 2005. Dr. McGuire has been discussing his experience in Cambodia, and also he's been applying that experience and the lessons learned in Cambodia to many other places and countries where genocide has occurred or where genocide is currently occurring. And one of the things that we just heard is the role of social media in this modern age in helping us understand what's going on around the world, and also creating an atmosphere of divide. But there is another point to social media, which has to do with empowering people and giving them the ability to understand what's going on and also to get their voices heard. And that leads us to the next question that we're going to be asking Dr. McGuire about conflict resolution using methods like diplomacy, mediation, dialogue, arbitration, and so on to resolve conflicts with ethnic and religious elements. We're going to be asking those questions when we come back from the short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back to you, listeners, and our esteemed guest, Dr. McGuire. Dr. McGuire, it's been a wonderful experience having you on air. Here at our radio, ICM radio program. One of the reasons why we began this initiative is not just to talk about the conflicts or, you know, the horrible things that have visited human nature and also visited our world. And all those who have lost their lives, including children and women, when you look at the images of all these victims, you just cry. Because as we're talking right now, a lot of people are in pain, and a lot of people are still not yet recovered from all these genocidal experiences they passed through. But right here, what will give them hope is honestly how to stop all these. When they occur, how to resolve them. And this brings us to this section of conflict resolution. I want to ask you, based on your own experience and your studies and research, the United Nations was actually created, which replaced the League of Nations in 1945. And the U.S. Was highly instrumental to forming, bringing people from many countries and people from many countries together in California, San Francisco, where the whole idea or the principles of the Charter of the United Nations was actually formulated and signed. I want to ask you, what do you make of the role of the United Nations in conflict resolution and peace building?
Well, it's interesting. I've been very critical of the UN with the trial in Cambodia at times, but nonetheless, I have great respect for many of the individuals working for the UN, in particular people like Craig Etchison and Richard Rant, and the legal figure who's impressed me the most was Judge Mark Harmon, an American. And, I see some systematic problems, but I also see some incredibly dedicated and brave individuals that can make a huge difference. Sadly, it does often come down to individuals and individual performances, which is hard to bank on. You know, sometimes you'll have incompetent individuals, but then sometimes you'll have, you know, true super achievers. I think, you know, until the conflicts are resolved, either at the diplomatic table or on the battlefield, it's very difficult to move to the next stage of reconciliation. Resolution of the conflict needs to occur, and that's really what prevented Cambodia from moving towards a restructuring of their society for, gosh, I mean, a good, let's see, Khmer Rouge were chased out in 79, and it really didn't get put on the table again until the early 90s. And it mainly was because the conflict remained unresolved. So I'm not a great optimist. I'll admit, but I do think that individuals can make a big difference. In my experience, I've worked with everyone. I've worked with people I don't like, I don't agree with, but nonetheless. I've been able to work with them, everyone from UN officials to Khmer Rouge to Vietnamese. And I think if people can sort of put their ideologies aside for a moment, it's possible for people with very disparate points of view to make forward progress.
Great. You've been doing this work, mobilizing folks for mediation or conflict resolution or alternative dispute resolution with the international experts who are dealing with these issues every day. And one of the difficulties that is often experienced actually when it comes to ethnic conflicts and religious conflicts is the inability of party leaders, especially ethnic leaders and religious leaders, sometimes those who are in conflict, in intractable conflict, to come together at the table of negotiation, at the table of mediation, to really find a way to reach an agreement that is actually mutually acceptable by both parties, and that we see in many countries. So what actually is the problem? Why is ethnic conflict and religious conflict, or even wars, or, you know, why are they so intractable that religious leaders or ethnic leaders, even those who are leading those efforts, are, you know, killing people, are so adamant, so difficult when it comes to conflict resolution and conflict mediation?
Well, these are our most, our most basic sets of beliefs, is our religious identity, our ethnic identity, our national identity, but even more than national, because a nation can be composed of many religions and ethnicities. And that's, as I was saying earlier, where it really comes back to, you know, this regression towards a tribal war, where you only identify with your tribe and all others are sort of guilty or, you know, evildoers. And I was very troubled in the beginning of the war on terror when it went from, you know, the Al-Qaeda was the enemy to Islamo-fascism. And these, you know, suddenly we've gone from a group of extremists working out of Saudi Arabia with camps in Africa and Afghanistan to populations of over a billion. And I would say to people, so are we going to, we're going to go and fight in Indonesia, where they've got one of the biggest Muslim populations in the world? It was like talking to children about international politics. And I put that blame squarely on the shoulders of the neoconservatives. And I think on some level that was their intention, that they wanted to forever disrupt American policy and relations in the Middle East and recreate it completely from the beginning, irrespective of international law or anything else.
Right. So then I guess, Dr. McGuire, if we're looking at all of these things and we're examining them as we have been today, where does accountability come into play?
Who becomes right out of my mouth? That's what I was,
right.
I was just about to say that. I think there needs to be accountability. I think, we were clearly lied to about the Iraq invasion. That's a bipartisan consensus now. I mean, there's no Mel Goodman from the CIA said very clearly before the invasion that there was no, that we had taken out all Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. So this ex post facto claim of really powerful and well-connected people, well, I just didn't have the right information and now I know what I know, that's absurd. And my feeling is that there needs to be a reckoning in order to move forward. And particularly in America, there's a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of scandals, and, you know, from Pat Tillman to Jessica Lynch to, you know, it's just, it's pathetic, really. It's shameful to me as an American. And I think that until someone's held accountable, even in the form of like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it doesn't necessarily need to be a judicial mechanism. Politically, I don't know if we can tolerate a judicial process in the United States at this point. But some people need to be held accountable. I mean, I don't understand how people like William Kristol or the ubiquitous Kagans and these people even have jobs anymore. If I had been that wrong about anything in my career, I'd go work as a lifeguard or a commercial fisherman and change my name and hide my head in shame.
Yeah.
Dr. McGuire, we have a caller on the line who is just going to ask you a question, and he's calling from Morocco. His name is Mark Tochi. Mark Tochi from Morocco. Please, can you ask Dr. McGuire your question, please?
Hey, Dr. McGuire, how are you doing this evening?
Oh, I'm pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm well. Do you think a stabilizing force independent of national interest that's held to a contract may be an answer or a possible solution to any of this mess?
It can, if there were terms and conditions of their participation. with the outsourcing of so much in the war on terror and the unaccountability of private military contractors, it's gotten very messy. I don't think it would be difficult to clean up. I had very good experiences with mercenaries in Southeast Asia, and my experience with them was that they weren't looking for conflict. They were almost acting like mediators. And so, but that was prior to the you know, advent of the Blackwaters, who were then subcontracted to U.S. government agencies and, you know, were kind of playing both sides of it. So it kind of needs to be brought under some kind of control, but, you know, potentially it's also dangerous to have, you know, powerful non-state actors armed and ready to go. So it's, you know, it raises quite a few questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McGuire. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we'll wrap up this very discussion. It's been an amazing, very instructive discussion with Dr. McGuire. Just stay tuned. When we come back, we continue.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back to you, our listeners, and our guest. We've been talking with Dr. McGuire, who is an expert in international law. And Dr. McGuire, we have a few questions, many questions. We've got so many people on the line here with us calling who want to ask questions, but because of time, we might not take all the questions. I have this very question that I reserved to this very moment, and I know my co-host Jackie has got another question that we want to ask you before we end this very discussion. Now, there are sometimes it's actually difficult to resolve international conflicts through mediation, through the good offices of the Secretary General, which has to do with mobilizing leaders of our international leaders and also the particular leaders involved in the conflict to reach an agreement based on the mandate of the United Nations and the resolutions that have been taken and the agreements those countries are involved in. Now, sometimes it's just difficult to get that done. And you have the peacekeeping missions of the UN. Their job is to separate the parties to a conflict in order to give way for these good offices of the Secretary General and mediation. Now, if that fails, there is another option, which is also conflict resolution, but it is a coercive measure. It has to do with resolving those conflicts by force. And the U.S. government is well known for that. I'm sure that's why they intervened in Libya, in Iraq. And right now, the discussion is going on in the this very campaign season to intervene in Syria and Iraq. What do you make of conflict resolution through a military means?
As you correctly pointed out, I see it as sort of a last option when everything else is broken down. But what I see as consistently problematic from where the United States, you know, policy is drives is that the political objectives are very unclear or unobtainable. For example, the Bush administration, they wanted a, quote, tsunami of freedom in the Middle East. What's that? How do you define that? How do you measure that? What metrics do you use? I mean, this is childish stuff. And I see, again, military, you know, military is the fist. Policy is the brain. And if the brain doesn't talk to the fist punches itself in the face. And so good intentions aren't enough. And there needs to be some coherence to policy, which is very, very difficult for the United States because of our political system. Every 4 to 8 years, we typically adopt a completely different, often contradictory policy, which makes it not only hard on our allies, incredibly dangerous on our allies. Why would they trust us if they know that we're going to go from Obama to Trump in, you know, the next election cycle? What is that? What are the implications for our allies? And so American foreign policy tends to be very, very short-sighted and geared to fit within election cycle timeframes. And that's where we have a problem. That's where we really, in terms of international political actors throughout history, we're very immature and childish compared to, you look at, the Bismarcks and the, Gladstones and people like that. You agree with them or disagree with them. Certainly they were imperialists and everything else, but they understood the game that they were playing and they knew the rules by which the game they were playing. They broke those rules, no doubt about it, but when they broke those rules, they knew they were breaking them, and they knew that there might be a price to pay for breaking those rules, where sometimes I feel like, we're being led by naive children or something.
Yeah. And Dr. McGuire, I guess then for our final question today, kind of wrapping up a lot of great points that we have been making today, it is difficult, I guess, to talk about prevention on issues that have been ongoing. And I guess maybe prevention is really a difficult word to use for international conflict and the use of international law. But moving forward, knowing all of the things that we know now, what are, in your opinion, best prevention measures that we can take on the national and international level when we are dealing with these genocides or these war crimes that do occur?
Well, I think there's clear signs when particularly now where we have instantaneous communications, it's very hard to bury things. For example, during World War II, several Holocaust survivors came, or people that even escaped from concentration camps, came to the United States and tried to impress upon American leaders what was happening. And they simply, nobody believed them. And that's become harder and harder to do. But I think what's a little sadder now that we see is that, before we could hide behind the fact, well, we didn't really know what was happening. It wasn't really clear. I mean, for example, during the Cambodian genocide, the person who did the most to detract from an international response to the Cambodian genocide was Noam Chomsky. He called into question every person who raised the specter that genocide was being carried out in Cambodia, and largely because the first person who called it genocide was Henry Kissinger. So you have these old political set pieces playing out in the context of new political problems, and that's very difficult to overcome. They're the people fighting old battles. And I think, I don't have a real easy answer for that. I've seen some great mediators. I've seen some great middlemen. It's very precarious and unpredictable, but a lot of it comes down to individuals and individual roles, mm-hmm. and the trust that they build. And over time, for example, there are things I can do in Cambodia a lot of other people can't do. And it's based on the 20 odd years I've spent over there and dealing with different people and keeping my word and doing what I said I was going to do and things like that. And it's very difficult for people to parachute into a situation where no one knows them and no one especially trusts them or anyone else. It really helps to have skilled regionalists that have an understanding of the culture and the language and the people and the history that they're dealing with.
Right. So it really is determined by having an expertise or an extreme familiarity with
the sociocultural and the sociopolitical environment that you're going into before indoctrinating.
For example, like, you know, Generals Redu and Laurie Dan, they really impressed me in Cambodia. Sergio de Milo, absolutely not.
Yes, absolutely.
Sergio de Milo was aiding and abetting the Khmer Rouge. He treated them as an equal partner in the election, as they were trying to disrupt the election as a matter of their policy the whole time, trying to reignite a civil war. And he was drinking wine with their leaders and kind of clinging to what, in my mind, is a very outdated concept of, quote, neutrality.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And listeners and those who are watching or listening to this very show, wherever they are, you are hearing Dr. Peter McGuire, the author of Law and War, International Law and American History. He spent so much time in Cambodia studying the Cambodian genocide, and now he came to share his experience with us and how to apply this experience and his findings in Cambodia to other countries where similar genocides have occurred. Dr. McGuire, this work he did is honestly a great thing for humanity. And I wonder if you had time to, you know, rest and, you know, kind of, I don't know how you ponder all that you saw over there. What exactly is your hobby? How do you really relax a little bit?
Surfing and martial arts. and cooking.
Wonderful. We're going to take this break, and when we come back, we end up.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
And so we want to thank Dr. Peter McGuire, the author of Law and War, International Law and American History, a book published in 2010 by Columbia University Press, and also the Facing Death in Cambodia, also published by Columbia University Press in 2005. You can find those books on Amazon and get a copy of those books and read them to understand exactly what happened and how we could change our world through the lessons learned and the practical examples that Dr. McGuire has provided us with. Dr. McGuire, thank you very much for the great work you have done and for the great work you're still doing. We hope to have you again for another episode of ICERM Radio. Thank you for coming, Dr. McGuire.
Oh, no, thank you. Anytime.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners, and those who have supported this very initiative. Remember, you can always come back to listen to this very show and to the podcast on our website, www.isermediation.org.
Yes, thank you, Basil, and thank you, Dr. McGuire. In addition to listening to the podcast, you can also get involved. There are many ways in which you can participate in this organization. You can sign up for the movement and get membership by registering for upcoming events, particularly our annual international conference on ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building that will be taking place in New York. You may also inquire about our specialized mediation training, the mediation of ethnic and religious conflict. We have a forum on our website, which you can also share your views. You can interact with others and post your comments.
Please join us next time for another episode of ICERM Radio. As always, I am Basil Okoje.
And I'm Jacqueline Kalaga. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. follow us on Twitter, and let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of iCIRM Radio.
Peace to our world.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can seem intense. Like breakup R&B intense.
I thought you said you love the sweater that I got you. If you didn't, you could have told me.
Geico makes it easy. Just go to Geico.com anytime to update or check your policy without all the extra drama.
I even had a gift receipt.
Firing up the grill? Having a picnic, going to a game, or the beach? Stop by Acme Markets for juicier Lancaster brand meats for the grill, fresher cut fruits and vegetables, tastier desserts from our bakery, and all of your snack needs. Don't miss the Entenmann's full line sale this week to get 50% off all Entenmann's 5.5 to 26 ounce packages. Plus, stop by Produce and pick up Northwest Sweet Cherries for just $1.99 a pound. Acme, your new favorite local supermarket.